So we're going to start. Jens will talk for half an hour, 45 minutes or so, and then we'll have a break, and then we'll come back and more presentation or questions. And Jens is here because of the swap meet that happened. He came to my booth and got a couple things and then wanted some more and then mentioned that he is an audio guy in a different part of the spectrum than we usually think of. It sounded like a great thing, so I'm really pleased to introduce our guest speaker, Jens, and I don't have much else to say about you. I don't know much more about you, but you're a smart
fellow. Okay, so we're going to talk about medical ultrasound, and one of the things that I'll do is, as we're kind of going through this, I'll sort of point out some of the similarities and differences to things that you guys might be, you know, familiar with in terms of regular old audible audio, not ultrasound. But there's going to be some differences also. So first of all, why would you listen to me? So I've been doing medical ultrasound for about 25 years. And I started out as an engineer, so I do know the details. This is not going to be a tremendously technical talk. If you want to ask questions, I can certainly try to answer them. I at least used to know all the answers, and at least I can make stuff up. And I've been pretty successful. We were talking earlier. I've been with, some of the larger ultrasound companies, ATL Ultrasound, which is now Philips Ultrasound, was a founder of Sonosite, which is a major ultrasound company now, and we'll talk about some of the other ones later. Founded a bunch of companies. I think I'm on my fifth ultrasound company now, four of which I was either a founder or co-founder of. So, been doing this for a while, and they seem to be working out, so that's good. And of course, super smart, entertaining dude. So and very humble. Yeah, actually, that's a good one. I'll put that in the punchline next time. All right. So, what is ultrasound? As you might expect, it's mechanical waves, but at a much higher frequency than you're used to in the audio spectrum. It's still a mechanical wave, and all that stuff still applies. So, but it's higher than you can hear. So it's more than, technically speaking, it's more than 20,000 hertz. Medical imaging is usually in the megahertz range. It's usually 2 to 10 megahertz. You can have specialty imaging, like skin imaging, stuff like that. It's up in the 25 megahertz range. That's what we're talking about. And then there's also therapeutic ultrasound, which I'll talk more about, and that's typically lower frequencies, in the 200 kilohertz to a couple of megahertz kind of range. But that's the sort of spectrum that we're talking about here. Diagnostic medical ultrasound has been around for quite a while. The consensus is it started out in the 40s. There was this guy in Austria who started using it in the early 1940s. And one of the nice things about working in ultrasound, in diagnostic ultrasound certainly, is that the clinical applications are wide and varied. I mean, you get exposed to all kinds of things. It's not like you go work for, a catheter company and now I'm doing cardiac and that's what I'm doing. You get to work in OBGYN, you get to work in musculoskeletal, you get to work in urology, vascular, whatever. And you learn a lot about these different areas. So that's a lot of fun. Therapeutic ultrasound is a little bit different. The use of ultrasound for therapy actually predates diagnostic ultrasound by a little bit, but these guys did not know what they were doing for quite some time. It was one of these, magic energy sources. You just kind of, lotions and potions kind of thing. However, the modern era of therapeutic ultrasound starts in the late 90s, early 2000s, and now there are some very serious applications for this, including treating brain cancers and things like this, which we'll talk a little bit more about later. So, range of current applications for what I'm calling a high-intensity focused ultrasound, as opposed to sort of the what I call physical therapy ultrasound that you might be familiar with. That's, high kilohertz, low megahertz, sort of tissue heating, sort of application. Focused ultrasound has a bunch of interesting applications, including getting after cancers, ophthalmic applications, women's health and aesthetics, and the last two are something I've actually run companies about, so I'll have some examples we can talk about there. So generating ultrasound, like I said, it's a mechanical wave, and there's no mystery how you create a mechanical wave. You got to have something move to launch that wave. Now, when you're talking about megahertz range stuff, you know, you can't have a cone speaker kind of thing. I mean, you need something with that's going to move a very tiny bit, or it has a tiny bit of mass, or both. And so what we usually do is use piezoelectric ceramics, mostly PZT, to do these things. And this is something that the Navy developed a long, long time ago for sonar applications. And the various forms of PZT live on to this day. More sophisticated versions now, but you know, I think you all understand the piezoelectric effect. I mean, basically, it's a crystalline structure. So if you squeeze it, you get a voltage out of it, and if you put a voltage into it, it deforms. So you put a voltage into it, it deforms. You can launch a mechanical wave, and it will respond, you know, very, very quickly. So you can launch these megahertz waves with this stuff. Wave interaction with materials. When you're talking about, you know, megahertz kind of ultrasound, the analogies are more with optics than they are with what you're used to maybe as audio. And so you have the key interactions that you'd be used to in optics, so transmission, reflection, refraction, scattering, absorption, things like this. And the interactions depend on the material properties, mainly the acoustic impedance of the materials that you're traveling through. And so, you know, there's a very simple answer to how, you know, your basic 2D black and white ultrasound image works. Basically, what you're seeing is reflections from the interfaces between different materials that have different acoustic impedances. And then the texture you see is scattering from things that are, you know, either on the order of or much less than the wavelength of the ultrasound that you're trying to interrogate it with. So, you know, transmission of the ultrasound wave, like I say, mechanical wave, and usually we talk about compressional waves. Now, there are special applications where you can use shear waves and other stuff like that, but 99% of what we're talking about is your usual compressional waves. So you have, you know, the wave moving through the material, and you have a compressional area, and you have a rarefactional area. So a positive pressure and a negative pressure as it propagates. Key parameters for ultrasound are exactly what you're used to. It's the wavelength, it's the frequency, it's the amplitude. Speed of sound, sort of interesting. That 1540 number, that's the number that every ultrasound engineer knows. It's an average. I mean, this is a typical thing. But the speeds do vary. You know, it'll travel faster in bone than it does in tissue, in soft tissue. And you can have fluid-filled structures where things will be a little slower. But that sort of puts it in context for some of the materials.
Is that human tissue?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And do individuals vary?
No, not really.
Speed I mean, no,
yeah, it's not enough to make any difference, put it that way. I mean, there's probably subtle variations, but it's not enough to make any difference.
And fat muscle are the same too?
No, they're slightly different, but again, we don't typically do compensation for fat versus muscle or anything else, except potentially in therapeutic ultrasound where, you know, a small shift in the focus might make a difference to you. Acoustic impedance, I think you're used to this as well. And the reason I put this up is basically that, you know, when we talk about reflections, you know, you're going through... you know, a bunch of tissue that has interfaces between different tissue types, And then these things have different acoustic impedances. And depending on the magnitude of the difference in the acoustic impedance, that determines how bright your reflection is going to be. And so if, for instance, you're going from soft tissue to bone, you're going to get a huge reflection. If you go from soft tissue to, you know, fluid, actually, you get a pretty big reflection as well. If you go from two different tissue types, it's going to be more subtle than that, but you can usually see it. And that's what we're usually trying to kind of drag out of the background. So in terms of things that you can see, reflection is certainly one of them. So you'll have your acoustic wave propagating along in one medium, and it'll make a transition into a second medium. Part of that energy is going to continue to propagate, and part of that energy is going to reflect, just like a transmission line. You know, all these things are sort of the same. And so, you know, as I was saying, the magnitude of the reflection is going to depend, you know, just like in electronics, on the magnitude of the difference in impedance. So if you're going tissue to air, you've got about a 99.9% reflection. Now, if you ever wondered why, you know, you've got the ultrasound probe and they goop you up with gel and then they start scanning away, why is that? Because you need to couple with no air. You can't really do it through the air. You lose all the intensity immediately. Same thing with tissue to bone. It's very difficult to image through bone, although there are specialty applications, you know, particularly like neonatal cephalic and things like that, where you are imaging through bone, but it's tough to do. Refraction, you will see, and where you usually see an effect like this is where you have like a cyst, a fluid-filled cyst in the middle of tissue, where there's, you know, a substantial change in the acoustic impedance, and you will actually be able to see things bend or appear in sort of slightly the wrong place. And sometimes you actually see, you know, ghost images of structures that are due to this effect. Scattering, yeah, this is a little bit different. Now, again, this is what happens when you have particles or structures in the tissue that are kind of on the same order of magnitude in terms of size as the wavelength of the ultrasound you're sending there. So you're not going to get a specular reflection. You're going to get it kind of going all over the place. And so there's a little animation here that I like. Come on. There you go. So, you know, instead of getting the specular reflection going straight back, you're going to get this kind of, it's going to scatter around all over the place. And when we get to looking at some 2D images here, I'll sort of point that out, that's what gives you the texture in an ultrasound image, not these bright specular reflections. And that actually carries diagnostic information. And like I said, we'll take a look at that in some images here. Absorption. So this is actually a pretty important effect that when the wave is propagating, some portion of that energy is going to be lost just to heat in the tissue, and it can be substantial, and it varies as the square of the frequency that you're using. So, you know, a much, much higher frequency is going to penetrate, you know, much less than a lower frequency is going to be. And so if you're talking about, you know, I gave you this range of 2 to 10 megahertz for typical medical ultrasound imaging, 2 megahertz is going to penetrate 30 centimeters. And so if you're looking at a big guy's heart or something like that, that's what you want to use. If you're looking at 10 megahertz or higher, you're probably only going to penetrate like 3 centimeters. And so, you know, this is for, you know, superficial vascular stuff, that kind of thing. Absorption is a really important thing to understand for medical ultrasound. As I said, the viscous losses result in heating, and when we get to the therapeutic part of this, that's actually the effect that you're going to use to do therapy with. You're going to do some fairly intense tissue heating, so we'll talk about that later. So again, you know, a couple of examples here. You know, 1 megahertz, lose half the power in 3 centimeters, and 100 kilohertz, you lose half your power in 30 centimeters.
So the operator is selecting the frequency based on what they want to accomplish?
Yeah. Yeah. And typically, so when you plug an ultrasound, when you plug an ultrasound probe into a system, the way they work these days, they have, you know, a modern ultrasound transducer has like 100% fractional bandwidth. And so if you have a 4 megahertz ultrasound transducer, it'll actually go from 2 to 6, and or 7 to 4, you know, what have you. And so you can actually, in a lot of systems, change the center frequency where you're transmitting and receiving. You can transmit and on one frequency and receive harmonics, actually, which is sort of interesting. And then, you know, for any particular application, you know, usually the sonographer will have available to them kind of an array of different probes, because there's also physical access aspects. Like, for instance, if you're doing cardiac imaging, you typically need to get between the ribs. And so you need a smaller footprint transducer than if you're doing a vascular study, where it's more important to have, you know, kind of a long transducer so you get, you know, a good panoramic view of the vessel. All right, focusing ultrasound. So ultrasound can be focused in tissue, mechanically, electronically, or both. And one of the sort of super important things about ultrasound is that it's really the only energy source that can be focused deep in tissue. So if you think about electromagnetic sources, whether it's RF or photonics or what have you, you know, if it's RF, the wavelengths are so long that you would have to have antenna the size of this room in order to be able to actually focus. And if you're using light energy, it scatters so much you can't use it. So ultrasound is really your only alternative to actually be able to focus deep in the body, which is obviously very important. And so, again, when we get to therapeutic ultrasound, that's going to become super important, that you can concentrate this energy but get it across the skin at a low enough intensity that you're not going to do a bunch of damage. And this is just a comparison of these are different wavelengths of light versus ultrasound in a certain aesthetic application, actually. And so what you see here is that basically if you're using light, it dumps all the energy into the skin. And if you're using ultrasound, you can actually bring the intensity up underneath, you know, at some significant depth. So if you ever go for like a cosmetic laser treatment, you'll find that what they do is they have active cooling at the skin surface. And so because they can't get away from that, you're dumping all the energy into the skin, they'll just try to cool the skin, you know, with basically cryogenic stuff, and then, you know, avoid damaging the skin that way, and then have the energy absorbed down lower. But they're not actually focusing it.
Is that what they're using the menthol gel for then?
I'm sorry?
Is that what they use the menthol gel for when they're using ultrasound therapy, is to cool the head?
No, that's for coupling.
Is for coupling?
Yeah. So for ultrasound, and the physical therapy ones are typically not focused. It just is, flat transducer that will, it'll have a natural focus, but it'll be very, very, you know, not very powerful focusing at all. And the gel is simply to get rid of that impedance problem so you're not going through air and reflecting all the energy back.
But for the laser, that's the one that's cooling the skin?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what's the cosmetic application?
Well, I'll actually show you that one, because that was a company that we had here in Seattle called Liposonics, and it was a non-invasive alternative to liposuction surgery. So you actually kill subcutaneous fat non-invasively as an alternative to liposuction surgery.
Awesome.
So potentially in a chiropractor's office?
Yeah.
Like through your clothes, if they say they're
no.
lasering you something,
well,
that's not this?
No. Yeah, I mean, typically none of this stuff is done through your clothes. That's just weird. So... no, I mean, any serious energy source, you need to have, you know, sort of direct contact. And so ultrasound has to be in direct contact, usually with some sort of coupling mechanism. Lasers, if it's a reasonable intensity laser that's going to do a lot for you, like, you know, treat skin lesions or what have you, again, typically it'll be placed right on your skin, and there'll be, you know, a sapphire window that they're shooting through, and that sapphire window is hooked up to some cryogenic stuff, and so that's cooled, and then it shoots laser through that sapphire window. All right. Mechanical focus is kind of exactly what it sounds like, that you can actually make these piezoelectric ceramics in bowl-shaped or, you know, whatever shape you want that's going to focus. You can make them parabolic, you can make them whatever you want, but it'll naturally focus the ultrasound sort of by itself. And so, you know, this is basically the idea that you have all, you know, every element of the front edge of this transducer sort of pointing at the same place. And this is an image in a Schlieren tank of an actual ultrasound transducer, you know, making this focus. And, you know, it's the usual effect that it's not a perfect focus because it's a finite aperture, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that's what a real ultrasound, a visualization of a real ultrasound pressure field looks like.
So the mechanical focus is not any kind of reflective thing. It's a generative process that is focused simply because of its shape.
Yep.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
So the image in that tank is there something in the liquid that lights up, or is it
no.
It's
water, and then you scan a laser through it, and so it'll actually diffract slightly differently, and so it's called a Schlieren effect,
okay.
And so, you know,
cool.
You buy a Schlieren tank and you get pretty pictures like that. electronic focusing is where you have multiple elements in an array, and it's just like beamforming that you would be used to in an audio setting. So, you know, you time, the basic idea is if you have an array like this and you're trying to focus here, the distance from here to the center element is less than the distance from here to the outer element. And so if you want all of the waveforms to arrive here in phase, you got to time them. Right? So you shoot the center one first, then you shoot the next two, then you shoot the next two, you know, out like that, so everything arrives in phase here. It's your classic beamforming exercise. And, you know, that's what we call a linear array. You can also have an annular array, where if you were looking at the face of the transducer, you have rings cut in the piezoelectric ceramic. And that allows you to, you know, basically change the, it doesn't allow you to steer from side to side, but it does allow you to steer in depth, right? Whereas if you've got a linear array there, it allows you to actually steer from side to side by changing the delays. So, you know, things would arrive in phase over here or over here rather than in the middle. Make sense?
So the design of the transducer, that controls the size of your focal zone.
No, you can't change the physical size, but you can do, for example, you know, reduced aperture, synthetic aperture, stuff like that, so you don't have to have everything active at the same time. You know, if you've got an array this big, it doesn't mean you have to use all of it, so you can use a reduced aperture, which is going to, you know, tend to screw up your depth of field. But if you have an array that's this big with a bazillion elements and you don't have enough electronic channels, then you can do synthetic aperture. So you shoot and you store it, and then you combine it all later.
Okay.
Make sense?
I think so.
Okay.
And waves at these frequencies function just as the same as waves at audio frequencies in terms of cancellations?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it's all just a mechanical... in fact... The way that this like destructive interference manifests itself is in speckle, and just like in lasers, So it's basically destructive interference, and so if you've ever looked at like you know, a laser pointer and you shine it at something, it's not a solid dot. You see this sort of speckly kind of pattern to it. And what that is that whatever surface you're shooting it at is not perfectly flat. And so some of it's in phase and some of it's out of phase, and you get this cancellation, you know. And so that's what it is. And you get that exact same thing here. And it follows a Rayleigh distribution, if you are interested in knowing that. All right. We were just talking about aperture versus depth of field. This is another optical sort of analogy, and it's exactly the same as using a camera. If you use a small aperture, you have a large depth of field. If you use a big aperture, you have a short depth of field, but your focus is actually improved, you know, in the focal zone. All right, and so it works exactly the same way. Let's see, so. Well, yeah, I think the point with this slide really is, again, if you want to maintain a tight focus at a deep depth, you need a pretty big aperture in order to do that. Right.
So that previous slide that you had there, I'm going to go back. So that's showing the top one that's a wide aperture.
Yeah, and so you don't have a lot of depth of field, but you have tighter focus.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the point at which the two blue lines are together is indicative of the depth of field. So the bottom one has a wider depth of field because those lines are together.
Yeah, it's more the slope of those lines, right? It's shallower in the bottom one.
Okay, thanks.
That would be if you're interested in something that obviously has a little more bigger depth.
Or, typically, you know, what you like to do usually in medical imaging, because resolution is important, is you like to use as big an aperture as you reasonably can. But again, if you're imaging through the ribs, you know, that limits what your aperture is going to be, right?
Yeah.
So it's often more a physical access issue than it is, you know, I'm going to really choose, like I do in a camera, to have more depth of field.
When you say through the ribs, that's placed on the surface of the ribs?
No, between the ribs, yeah.
But shooting through, it's not penetrating through between the ribs.
So no, it exactly does that. Well, it rests on the surface, obviously, between the ribs.
That was the obvious part that I wanted
to clarify. All right. Yeah, no, you're not shoving it in there, hope you're not.
Thank you. I'll remember that next time.
Yes. All right. So, you know, mechanical versus electronic focus, I think, has, you know, some of the advantages and disadvantages that you might expect. Mechanical focus, it's simple. You know, you set it and forget it. You make it once and it's done. It has the best possible spatial control over energy for a given aperture. The disadvantage is that, you know, it's got one focus and that's it. And so if you want to focus somewhere else, you got to physically move it. And, you know, either you move it side to side or you move it up and down or what have you. And so in the old days when I worked at ATL, we had an annular array that was mounted on a motor, and it would just wobble back and forth. And, you know, exactly sort of the same thing. We had fixed focus ones that would actually spin all the way around, and you'd have three transducers on this thing that spun around. And so the spinning would give you the sweep spatially, and it was just, you know, one of them finished, then the other one started. Okay? So the advantage of electronic focus is you can steer and focus the beam, you know, pretty much anywhere you want, electronically, so there's no motion involved with that, but you've got side lobes, you've got grating lobes, you've got all the usual artifacts that you're going to get from an electronically beamformed acquisition process. It's more complex and expensive, and so you're not going to have as good energy control as you do for a mechanically focused transducer. Now, essentially all modern ultrasound transducers are array systems that use electronic steering. I'm not aware of a mechanical one out there really anymore, except for certain specialty Doppler kind of and ophthalmic sort of things. However, for therapeutic ultrasound systems, it can still be super important because, again, where you've got, you know, let's say that energy control is not perfect in an imaging situation. How does that manifest itself? Well, you know, a little brightness here, a little brightness there in the image that maybe isn't perfect, which, you know, as long as the image, you know, is generally good, no one cares. If you're doing therapeutic ultrasound with, you know, 1,000 times the energy, well, your side lobes come up, you know, maybe you're hurting somebody over there. So that's not good. And so it turns out that in therapeutic ultrasound, actually, the better systems, i.e. the ones that I'm involved in making, are using mechanical focus transducers. And this last point here, where I say hybrid focus is possible, you can actually make, for example, an annular array in a curved bowl, so it has a natural focus, but you can also change that focus by beamforming with the annuli of the array.
Is it fair to assume that technology moving at such a rapid pace that the actual technicians will at some point be out of a job?
No, not in the foreseeable future. The hardest part about ultrasound is actually getting the image that you want, and there's real skill in that. And there's all kinds of people interested in automating this process more, particularly for like low resource areas in underdeveloped countries and so on. And you know, periodically someone will call me up and say, you know, hey, I've got this great idea. You know, we're going to do this ultrasound project where we're going to have these people with no training, you know, getting the images, and then we're going to have some, you know, big dude at Mayo Clinic interpreting those images. And every time I tell him, it isn't going to work, because you really got to be able to get the image, otherwise you don't have the data that you really need. And then the next phrase out of their mouth is, oh, yeah, but we're just going to do this big 3D acquisition, and then we can slice it and dice it any way we want. Well, actually, you can't, because, you know, we'll talk about image artifacts here, but you actually have to be careful about what angle you're coming at, and, you know, is there any bone in there, particularly if you're talking about fetal imaging, which often you are. You know, you actually have to be coming from the right side in order to see what it is you need to see. So no, you can tell your buddies who are in training for ultrasound that, yeah, no, their jobs are safe.
So the mechanical focus seemed like it was pretty obvious how this done. How does electronic focus work? Is it changing aperture?
No, you don't necessarily change it. Although, you know, now that you say it, you often do change aperture as you're doing different depth, and so you like to open up the aperture as you're going to deeper depths. But it's more about timing. So if you have an array of transducers, it's more about timing when you send a pulse from those to get everything to arrive in phase at the same point. So, you know, kind of back to this picture here. So if that's the array there, like I was saying, and this is where I'm trying to focus, then the distance from there to the center of the array is shorter than the distance from here to the outer element there. And so if I want a wavefront to arrive at the same time from every element of that array, I've got to measure the distance from the face of the array down to this point that I'm trying to focus at, understand what's the speed of sound, you know, in getting here, and then, you know, there's going to be, you know, a few microseconds difference in when I send the pulse from each of those, so that the pulse, the mechanical pulse from each of those arrives here in phase at the same time.
You also change the frequency?
Not usually when you're making just one image. I mean, it's, you know, the frequency is usually sort of a set it and forget it. I mean, either I want a low frequency or I want a high frequency, or, you know, something like that. There are certain applications where, for instance, an image enhancement technique that's called frequency compounding, where actually you take the same image at two different frequencies and then meld them together in a certain way that can give you, you know, kind of enhanced resolution, but it also gives you better penetration.
So this is a simplified drawing of an array.
Yeah.
They don't have nine elements.
No. Yeah, typically they have, you know, a typical linear array will have like 192 elements, something like that. You know, if you're talking about a 2D array, I think the biggest one I've ever seen is 512. I mean, usually it's like, you know, 256 is kind of a practical limit for what people are used to doing. The smallest sort of modern one that I'm aware of is probably around 64, and that's a small phased array for cardiac applications.
So you're using some kind of delays to
Yes.
Effective, so you've
yes.
got a lot of delays in this box.
Right, and usually that's a digital thing these days. And so the architecture of one of these things is basically, you know, you have on the transmit side, you've got pulsers that have fine delays, you know, electronically in front of them. And then on receive, you've got, you know, a transmit receive switch, and then you have an A to D converter, and then it's in digital, and there's, you know, you gotta have enough, you know, delay resolution to be able to beamform at whatever level you want to beamform.
And the operator has a knob or something to set all of these together, all of these delays?
No, that's done behind the scenes. All they're looking at is an image. The operator's got nothing to do with beamformation or anything else. I mean, they can choose frequencies, they can choose depth, they can choose, you know, other things like that, but nothing really.
So they
with
choose the
information.
Depth and it sets the delays.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was trying to ask.
In the array design, is it actually a linear thing, and then you make the compensation?
Yeah, you can have different kinds. And so, for instance, if you're doing a vascular application, they're literally flat. And if you have an abdominal application, they're often curved. And so you get a wider field of view.
Receiver in the same location as the emitter transmitter?
Usually, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's the method of changing the aperture? So using more and fewer elements?
Exactly right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like you were mentioning before, yeah. You could also use bigger clusters of elements.
And then add them up later to beamform, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the signal driving the piezo transducer, is it a sine wave? Is it a square wave?
It's somewhere in between. It's usually pretty simple. And so because a lot of this stuff gets filtered out, I mean, you can use square waves. And, you know, in the very sophisticated systems, there's probably, you know, like, I think the most I've ever seen is like 6 bits. So, you know, you can have, you know, you can approximate whatever waveform you want, but you've only got 6 bits to do it in, kind of thing.
So does it take divided by 2 to drive these things?
Yeah. No, exactly right. And it's not even necessarily divided by 2, because if you're focused straight ahead, or if you have a curved array and you're moving your aperture along, then there's the symmetry that you can take advantage of, you know, both on transmit and receive, and, you know, have your number of transmitters and have your number of receivers. But if you're using what we call a phased array, where you're really steering out beyond the edge of the transducer, then all the delays are different. And so you've got to have a transmitter and a receiver for every one.
You know, the receivers are separate elements than the transmitters?
No, it's all the same thing.
You use reciprocity then?
Yeah, you know, you shoot and then you listen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of going back a bit, you mentioned initially, you know, radar from roughly World War II days, mm-hmm. or something like that. Piezo devices were what, early 60s or somewhere around there? I don't remember exactly.
No, I mean, that's...
Was it earlier?
You're going back into the 40s.
Oh, it was over, okay.
Yeah, and remember, they're using quartz.
Well, I know, stuff. I'm thinking of audio manifestation. Microphone manifestations.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, same sort of thing. I mean, they're using quartz crystals in the battle days there too,
well,
right?
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, but you said around 2000 was when the, maybe it's more modern. What was there, a threshold? Was there a development or what happened?
Well, let's defer that until we get to the therapeutic ultrasound,
right.
Because it's not the diagnostic ultrasound that I was talking about. It's the therapeutic ultrasound that sort of started making leaps in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
The diagnostic ultrasound has been, you know, fairly steady, you know, over the course of, you know, almost, you know, I guess, the last 70 years now.
So how much energy did you get back with?
Sends yeah, not very much. At least
compared to a speaker.
Well, something like that. And so, I mean, to give you an idea of the energy levels that we're talking about, the FDA limit for intensity at any point in an ultrasound field is 720 milliwatts per square centimeter, which is not a ton. And so, when you're receiving stuff back, I mean, you're talking about microvolts. So, you know, you have to have a very, very clean system to be able to do this. All right. Okay. Let's see where it was here. Oh, yeah, images. Okay, so, you know, we've got all this great technology, and we've got all this physics. And, okay, so let's, now we got to make some pictures. So let's look at that. Here's the first picture that everybody sees. And most of the pictures I'm taking are from Sonosite. I figured since I was one of the founders of the company, I can take those pictures. So, you know, fetal profile, yeah, it looks pretty good. And I'll show you a different fetal picture a little bit later. But, you know, I guess things to notice in this image, you know, up top, you can see sort of some bright reflectors. You know, those are really interfaces between different tissue types. But then, like, in here, that's, you know, there's not really bright reflections. There's just sort of a texture associated with it. That's the scattering. Oh, you got a pointer? Great.
Up there.
Scattered. Yes. Yeah. So in here, you know, there's really not bright reflectors that you're seeing, but you see this sort of grayscale texture, that's scattering. So that's what that looks like. Dark areas are fluid. There's nothing in there to scatter or reflect. So this is amniotic fluid here. This looks like probably part of his arm over here. So anyway, nice 2D picture. And again, this is a curved array. So you can see up on the top there. Oh, so yeah. This is a 60 millimeter curved array. And he says right there, C60. And you know, the depth, where's the depth? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, so this is probably 12 centimeters down 12. Here.
12.6 centimeters. Isn't that what
that's? Oh, that's, yeah, right, exactly. Guess
what
I should
are those
just
other
read
numbers?
All right, what do we got here? Okay, so here, okay, so this is a C, it says C60, which means it's a curved array, 60 millimeters radius, XP is just the model. 5-2, this is the frequency range of the transducer, so it goes from 2 megahertz to 5 megahertz. MI and TI, so MI is, these are measures of intensity of the ultrasound. So MI is mechanical index, and this gives you a relative measure of what's the danger of cavitation, which we'll talk about later. You know, it's an unwanted effect. And then TI is thermal index, which is sort of an index of the danger of heating the tissue to a level that you don't necessarily want. And, you know, typically you like to have these things below 1. The FDA limit for MI is 1.9, I forget what it is for TI, but you know that's what they mean. Over here, these are just presets basically. So G is general imaging, you know, 50. I don't know what that means. THI means tissue harmonic imaging, and that's one of these things where you know, you can get nonlinear effects. So if you transmit ultrasound at one frequency, there's actually going to be a nonlinear interaction with the tissue that's going to allow you to receive in at twice that frequency, you know, and at other harmonics of it. Now, you remember that, you know, the resolution that you get is going to be proportional to the wavelength, right? Short wavelength is going to give you better resolution, but short wavelength is also going to give you less penetration, all right? So the idea here is that because the harmonics are actually generated at depth due to this nonlinear interaction, you're only traveling half the distance with the high frequency, right? So you go down with the low frequency and you go back with the high frequency, not round trip with high frequency. So you cut your attenuation in half.
So with the MI and TI, FDA, regulations, with the products that you create, are you putting some kind of regulator in them, or is that up to the technician?
Well, no, I mean, there's no knob that the technician can move that will allow you to go above an FDA limit. I mean, that's just part of the deal with this. And so, you know, when we're making one of these things, we have some pretty sophisticated acoustic tanks with hydrophones, and we measure, you know, every transducer at every transducer at every possible setting to make sure that there's no point at which it exceeds an FDA limit. And then, you know, based on what the technician wants to do, then we're simply displaying, you know, where you're at.
Chins, in this case, we're looking at a fetus.
Yeah.
maybe in another case you're looking at, I don't know, lever or whatever, you know, is the limit the same? Or is the limit, you know, FDA?
That's actually a good question. And so there is a lower limit for particularly neonatal cephalic. So if you're trying to image a kid's brain, then the limit is lower than, and that's the intensity measure usually that you're looking at there.
Within a fetus, though, would it be pretty much whatever it is, or they don't modulate that with age, I wouldn't think.
No. But, you know, for fetal imaging, the limit, you know, so the adult limit is 720, the fetal limit is 360, I think. So half.
Within the FDA mandated limits, does the operator have control over intensity?
Usually that's cooked into the machine, and so you can pick things around it that are going to change the intensity. Like, you know, if you pick a preset that's a penetration preset, then maybe you get a little bit more juice. But you know, I guess my experience is that usually you like to have the presets kind of running as hot as you can to get the best contrast resolution. You get the most information back.
Right.
All right. That's an adult heart. So apical four-chamber view of the heart. Left ventricle, left atrium, right ventricle, mitral valve there, tricuspid valve there, aortic valve there. So that's actually a pretty good picture. And you'll notice that the kind of visual quality of these images, you know, sort of varies depending on what you're looking at. Like in the heart here, really the only thing you're interested in is, you know, is it structure or is it fluid? And so it's kind of very black and white. There's not a lot of gray to it. Whereas, you know, we look at some of the other pictures that I'll show you in a minute here, there's going to be much more sort of gray texture to them because that's more important in those applications.
These pictures, as you said, are being taken from this direction down, and it's showing a plane. I've always imagined the picture being where the camera is where my eyes are, and it's not that at all. It's looking this way. So, and it's a very fine depth this way. So, are you able to show pictures?
Yep. And actually, you can combine those into 3D images if you want. I'll show a little bit of that later.
Okay, thanks. That's great.
One question about this. I mean, obviously, the heart is beating, so I presume.
Yep.
And what resolution does the job?
For a picture like this, I mean, you don't need anything better than, you know, a millimeter or so. I mean, it's a pretty big.
It tells you what you need.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas, you know, if you're looking for the extent of a skin cancer or something, I mean, you need micron kind of resolution, and so you're much higher frequency. This is one where it shows you a little bit more of sort of this texture and kind of the resolution that you can get in a modern ultrasound system. So this is breast imaging, and so you can actually see one of the lymph nodes here and one of the arteries in the breast, and then this is just, you know, the texture of the breast, the various, you know, fatty layers, the muscular layers, and so on. And then you get the bright reflections off the interfaces between those layers. That's actually really...
The green thing up on the left?
Oh, that's just an orientation marker. So, you know, if you've got a linear array, it's symmetrical, so you have a mark on one side so you know which ways you're pointing. So, you know, we looked at a couple of 2D images. We've talked some about the, you know, different kind of optical effects you can get there. And so you see that, you know, you've got this image here, and there's a cyst or an artery or something here. You see how it's brighter behind it? Anybody want to guess why? You should be able to do this given the information I gave you.
The reflection.
It goes through faster?
No.
Liquid?
Something hard.
It's attenuation, right? there's almost no attenuation in the fluid, and there is in the tissue. And so if you're going through a tissue path, then you lose more energy than if you're going through a fluid path. And so you're going to get a brighter response after the fluid path.
So it's a lack of attenuation.
Exactly. Yep. All right, here's another one where you're getting a shadow. All right, so this is the bladder. That's a kidney stone that came down and is about to cause problems. And so you get this, you know, it's huge reflection off of this. That's why it's totally white, and it blocks the energy from going through it. Right? Reverb.
This is Mars.
Yeah, that's coming up. What this is showing, this is they're aspirating a cyst here. This is a needle, so it's you know, hard piece of stainless steel, right? You're getting huge reflections off of it. And that's what you're seeing. You see these repeated reflections, you know, bouncing back and forth between the transducer and the needle. All right, here's another imaging mode, color flow. So this is often incorrectly called color Doppler. You're not really doing a Doppler analysis here, but what you do with this is basically a correlation analysis. So it's a two-dimensional thing, and what in here, you know, there's little column pixels or voxels where you're interrogating what is the flow rate, and basically you're going to get not more than about 12 samples in there. And so it's not enough to, you know, do an FFT and, you know, figure out the frequencies and all this other stuff. Basically it's a correlation thing. And so you put this into a correlation algorithm. You see how much the signal sort of, you know, moves from one side to the other. You can figure out which direction the blood is going, and by the displacement you can figure out kind of how fast it's going. And that's what's encoded in this image. And this is a real-time image. I mean, I don't think it shows the frame rate here, but you know, you can get this at 30 frames a second. And yeah, so you see real time flow. You can see it in the heart. I have a heart picture coming up here. And this is kind of just, you know, a classic kind of interesting picture, because you've got the carotid here and the jugular here. And so you see, you know, both totally filled up bright vessels, but going the opposite direction in flow. Right?
What's the more yellowy?
It's in this color map, it's just faster. Right, so this is 24 centimeters per second, and this is minus 24 centimeters per second. So if the, you know, light blue, like here, this is faster. You know, the middle of the vessel is usually faster than the outside of the vessel.
What does minus mean in speed?
Direction. Well, it's just direction,
oh,
right?
Direction.
Yeah. Now here's one, which is a good application of, you know, what is the application for color flow? This is a cardiac image. So this is the four-chamber apical view that you saw before. This is the left ventricle. This is the left atrium. That's the mitral valve there. All this flow that you see down here is the atrium filling. And so the mitral valve should be closed, and there should be no flow up here. But there is. That means the mitral valve's leaking, right? And that's, you know, if you have a heart murmur or something like that, that's what that is, basically. You got a valve that's leaking. This is how you diagnose it. Valve's closed, there should be no flow up here, but there is.
That would enable you to not only see it, but you can get a pretty darn good idea of the degree.
Or just how bad it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so, you know, I've seen ones in the clinic where you have what's called flail valves, where, you know, I don't know how much you know about the structure of the heart, but there's these valves here, and then there's actually these sort of tethers that are called tendinae that anchor them to the side of the heart. If those are broken, you get a flail valve that just flops around, and so it's almost completely incompetent as a valve.
And this color's added by the device, not later?
Yeah, no, this is real-time mode, and so you turn on color, that's exactly what you're going to see.
Is there an ultrasound analog to contrast mediums used by radiologists?
Yes, microbubbles. And so, you know, if you put in little microspheres, they're going to tend to scatter more intensely than, you know, certainly the blood will, and that's what you'll see. So another mode that's not color strictly, it's called power mode. And basically, this is it's a quote-unquote Doppler mode, but it's this correlation mechanism again. But you're throwing out the directional information, so you don't care what direction the blood flow is going. And the reason you do that is because then you actually get better sensitivity for the flow measurement, right? Because you throw out one piece of information, then you can increase your sensitivity. And so this is actually a nice picture of the vessels in a kidney. You know, you see this classic sort of tree structure here. The renal artery is down here, and it branches out into this tree structure. You can see the capsule of the kidney kind of going like that.
Is the lighter color more flow? Or
it's just more power, yeah, so more flow.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And then there's spectral Doppler. Now this is real Doppler. And so here what you do is, so if you look at the reference image up here, you've got your 2D image, and then you've got a vessel here, and then you see this line coming down through it. And what's tough to see is that on that line there's a little box right there. Okay, that's called the sample volume. And here you really do collect like 256 samples or 512 samples or something like this, run an FFT on it, you figure out the frequency shifts, and then you display it as a spectrum here. Okay, and so this is particularly used in vascular studies, where you really want to understand, you know, how fast is the fastest flow, or, you know, how slow is the flow in diastole, something like that.
Is the PW?
Where are we?
Upper left-hand corner.
Oh, pulse wave, as opposed to continuous wave. Okay. And that's the Doppler frequency there. Which means that's how much bandwidth you're using. You're still at this, you know, high carrier frequency up in the megahertz range, but that's the Doppler bandwidth that you're using. All right. There's a 3D picture. So, yeah, this is a total beauty shot that it's very rarely you get a picture that looks that nice. But this is made up of just 2D echo. So you take these 2D slices and you sweep through the whatever it is that you're trying to image. And the reason that these field images show up so nice is because it's surrounded by amniotic fluid, and so there's nothing blocking in front of it. You know, usually you got the kid's face is crammed up against the side here or something like that, and you don't get a beautiful picture
like
that.
What age is that?
This is pretty far along. I mean, I would guess it's 7 or 8 months. And then, you know, you'll sometimes hear the terminology 4D. Basically, that's 3D with motion. So, and that's often used in cardiac.
Is that a big seller for?
It's total eye candy. There's no diagnosis that's ever made using this.
The parents would love it.
Yeah.
Other than there's a baby in there.
There is in fact a baby in there, but I could have told you that with the first picture. and I can tell you, I mean, you know, there's all these fetal growth measurements that are made, you know, to determine gestational age, to determine whether the fetus is growing normally, all that stuff. None of it's done in 3D. It's all done in 2D. All right.
How much energy does the fetus receive from the imaging procedure?
Well, I mean, hopefully not a ton. And it's, you know, again, the limits are lower for fetal imaging. So, you know, intensities are, you know, the 300 some odd milliwatts per square centimeter. And there's been a bunch of bioeffect studies that, you know, will tend to show that that's not going to harm anything.
And the frequency is really high. So it's not
actually it's not super high, right? Because you're going.
It's not audible. It's not audible.
No, absolutely not. I mean, you're still up in the, you know, probably 4 or 5 megahertz range.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So is an image like like this typically covered by insurance, or is this
you know, no, and it falls in a bundle payment. I mean, what the insurance will pay for is a fetal study, and fetal imaging. The fetal imaging centers will compete based on features, and so, you know, if you have a choice of imaging centers to go to, if you're pregnant, you know, you can go to this one where you'll get all the measurements, you get everything you absolutely need in order to ensure that the kid is healthy. But you don't get a 3D image, and you go to this other one, you get all that stuff, and they'll, you know, scan you out a 3D image to take home, put on the fridge. Which one are you going to go to, right? So, it's you know, I used to work on 3D ultrasound, and this, I hate to say it, I mean, it's more gimmicky than anything else. Where 3D ultrasound is actually fairly useful sometimes is, and I didn't bring a picture of this, is in flow imaging. And so, this is something that I worked on, you know, back in the bad old days at ATL. This is mid-90s. We actually did the first 3D flow imaging system, and the first image we made was in a fetus, where we scanned basically from here to here, and you could see the heart, you could see the ascending aorta, the aortic arch, the, you know, carotids coming up, circle of Willis inside the head. It was just this beautiful image that no one had ever seen before. And so that was cool. And that you can actually use for diagnoses, right, for vascular disorders, that kind of thing. And, you know, I mean, to be fair, if, you know, for instance, there's, you know, you're seeing the 2D image that there's cleft palate or something like that, and you want to understand how bad it is, then often it's useful to have a 3D image. All right? So that's kind of the end of the diagnostic ultrasound part of this. Any other questions on diagnostic before we go to therapeutic? Mm-hmm. And do you want to take a break and come back to this, or do you want me to keep plowing ahead?
Yeah, the break would be good.
Okay.
Great, thank you. That's good.